Stu Does America.
Welcome to the program. It is the second to last show we're ever going to do here at Stu Does America. And I'm doing it from a foreign location. It's not that foreign, a couple hours away. We kind of, schedule's been kind of messy, honestly, with all of the transition. We've been trying to figure everything out. We thought we were going to be off at this time. Instead, we are here doing shows, and we're going to be off next week in preparation for the big transition to Stu and Dave Do America, part of your Blaze TV subscription. If you want to be a Blaze TV subscriber, it's a great community. There's a lot of awesome shows here. We do really cool stuff and great coverage of big events. And I think you're really going to enjoy the whole situation if you join up. It's blazetv.com. If you use the code Stu and Dave 42, you can save $42. We did that to go above Pat. It was at $41 off. So $42 off Stu and Dave 42. Feel free to join. We would love to have you as part of the team. But we were kind of thinking we were going to be back in near the home base. We're away for a couple of nights. This is my kids' spring break. So we are at a location far, far away. We will have Rob Eno, which is an interview that we actually taped yesterday. He's going to be on with us today from the studio here in just a few minutes. We've got Dan Andros as well joining us with some pretty cool news. It's going to be kind of related to Predictable, the PredictableShow.com situation that we're doing. We've got a Substack there that's going to be writing about all these prediction markets here. That's starting in a couple of weeks. And then also, of course, the show, Predictable, with Stu, that is starting as well in a few weeks. So kind of been a crazy time for me, honestly, and I appreciate you kind of dealing with all of the ups and downs of trying to get everything scheduled and moving everything around. Thanks so much for joining us here on Stu Does America. I will be back in the studio, though, for the final show of Stu Does America tomorrow. So that'll be a lot of fun as well. I did want to talk to you a little bit about today, and we're doing the Squad's Illinois Fail. And of course, we're going to be diving deep into these elections over the next several months. It's going to be a big focus for us. The way the schedule works out is kind of interesting. We'll go through this here in a second. After Illinois, we get kind of a break until the primary season really kicks into full gear. But what we saw in Illinois was a situation where you've got obviously a bright, bright, bright blue state, right? This is the bluest of the blue, basically, where you can kind of do whatever you want if you're a Democrat. So you have these factions of the Democratic Party warring with each other. They're fighting, they're going back and forth, trying to take control. Of course, one of the big groups that is trying to do that is the sort of Squad left, the AOC left, everybody in the Squad is the Ilhan Omars of the world, but even go down to like the Jasmine Crocketts of the world. It's that sort of vibe of leftist, right? Someone who's very, very socialist leaning, very, very anti-Israel, very, pro-abortion and trans, like everything as far as you can go. And they had a play here in Illinois. They had a chance to do something. They had a chance to move the needle a little bit, and it did not work. The Squad left suffers a complete wipeout in Illinois, according to Axios. They say the left suffered virtually a total collapse in the Illinois Democratic congressional primaries Tuesday night, even in races where the AIPAC-backed candidate lost. I'm going to get into the AIPAC part of this here in a second. It's a bad sign for the dozens of insurgent Democrats running in congressional races across the country, both in open seats and as primary rivals to older or more establishment-oriented incumbents. And it's great news for House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries from New York, who's most popular among the moderate and mainstream liberal wings of his party. Most of the Democratic House candidates who have refused to commit to supporting Jeffries for leader or speaker are leftist insurgents. So in a way, it is a win for Jeffries, which is hard to kind of get your arm or wrap your arms around, mainly because Jeffries is kind of a giant zilch. Like, he's the type of guy who honestly you don't get much out of. He's really not a factor in our day-to-day politics. He's not a guy that you look forward to seeing comments about on TV. Back in Pelosi's day, while she was annoying and I didn't like her, she was effective in a certain way for Democrats. And she was, of course, always on TV getting the left-wing position out there. Jeffries is just not really good at it. You know, I mean, he's just, you know, kind of like a just a bad kind of zilch of a guy. And that is not something that necessarily helps the Democrats. He's trying to hold on to power, though. And there was, we covered this the other day, there's a chance of the far, far left kind of going after him and taking away his power, trying to unseat him from House leadership. Now, look, I should look for, honestly, a prediction market on this because I'm not all that. I'm not a big believer in that. If they win the House, the chances of him losing power as a head of the House, I think, would be very, very low. Maybe we can look that up and I'll check that out. Maybe write about it over at Predictable Show because it does seem like an opportunity that's a pretty kind of near a sure thing for Hakeem Jeffries to maintain power. We will see on that one. Now, one of the big focuses of these races, though, and all these squad types went down. Another way to talk about the squad is the Hamas wing of the party, right? These are people who kind of sort of cheered on October 7th. Maybe some of them just winked at it. Maybe some of them just liked posts by other people who said they were cheering on the death of the Jews. You know, just very loose. Very, like, you can't take anything out of it. It's like Mom Donnie's wife. Who knows what she meant when she liked a tweet about a bunch of Jews being slaughtered and raped? Who knows? Could be anything. Anyway, so the Hamas wing of the party, you know, one of the organizations that's kind of noticed that this wing of the party is trying to take power is AIPAC. And AIPAC is like, I don't know. They're supposedly the ultimate villains of all of the world right now. Because a lot of people, even on the right, certainly plenty on the left, are blaming them for pushing us into war with Iran and, all sorts of different things. They were very excited about these results because they put a lot of money into these races to try to stop very hardcore anti-Israel candidates from winning those primaries. AIPAC writes, life looks pretty good. Voters in North Carolina and Illinois rejected all seven far left would-be squad members who centered their campaigns on attacking Israel and demonizing pro-Israel Americans. Being pro-Israel is good policy and good politics. Now, it's interesting because I think if you're online a lot, you probably don't feel that way, right? Like if you're on Twitter a lot, you probably look at this issue and are like, gosh, you know, everyone seems to be anti-Israel these days in the party. And there are many voices that are. And to be clear, believe what you want, right? Like if you think Israel sucks, if you think Israel is the aggressor in the war with Iran, if you think that they did too much in Gaza, you know, there is a certain cutout of that group, which is, you know, making arguments against Israel's policies, which is totally fine. It's honestly almost boring, right? Like it's like criticizing another nation's approach to foreign policy is very generic as far as the discourse in our country. You, of course, should be able to do that. No one's stopping you from doing that. A lot of people say that people are being stopped from doing that. They don't seem to stop themselves, frankly. They seem to keep doing it as much as they want. Which is fine. You can talk about that all you want. Now, of course, there's a certain subset of those people who don't seem to against Jews. I have no time for that particular stuff. But I think we lose sight as to whether this is a popular thing among Republicans. And, you know, supporting Israel has always been very popular among Republicans. There certainly is a movement on the right, part of it, which is opposing Israel more and more. And that is definitely a real thing, at least online. But in the polls, it's kind of hard to detect. There's a new poll out about the military action in Iran. And when you look at Republicans overall, 77% of Republicans support the action in Iran. Which is interesting because I don't know if it feels that way, at least in conservative media these days. It doesn't feel like it's 77% support, but it is. And you might say, well, there's a certain subset, though, that is important. A lot of people from Donald Trump's base who are very strongly against it. And again, I can't disagree with that. There are really people who are super opposed to what's going on in Iran and super opposed to what's going on in Israel. If you've missed my shows about this, my view is sort of nuanced on it. Honestly, like I'm much more in favor of what's happened in Iran than some of the people that I know, but I am very I am scared of it swinging out of control. And, you know, we had that sort of concept we were talking about where you're talking about, is there an opportunity for success in this war? And I think, yes. Is there a justification for this war in Iran? I think with the history of what Iran has done, I'd say absolutely yes. But the third one is it a necessity? And did you necessarily need to go to war right now with Iran? That's really the bigger line. So anyway, by the way, the MAGA group, they asked the MAGA group whether they supported the war. It was 89%, so much higher among Donald Trump supporters than Republicans overall. We also had lefty influencer Kat, and again, a bunch of there's Z's and G's and H's next to each other. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but they lost their Illinois House primary to Evanston Mayor Daniel Biss, another loss. Just searching through these headlines here. The other big one, let me just give you this one. Juliana Stratton won the primary. This was another one we talked about. It was a bad night for the squad, kind of a good night for J.B. Pritzker, not just because they had an all-you-can-eat buffet in the after party, but it was he supported Stratton over, again, another guy I'm not going to even attempt to pronounce his name. He lost, so I don't have to learn it. Raja, he wound up losing. The kind of left-wing candidate was the person who finished in third. The interesting part about this, by the way, Stratton was at 40%. Raja at 33, Kelly at 18%. The interesting part about this is it really does. It's like one of those things when you're thinking of prediction markets, that was a 50-50 race. I didn't know who was going to win that race. And it's important to understand when you're looking at prediction markets, we'll get into more of this on prediction show, predictable show.com. It's okay to not have a position on every one of these. It's important to understand when you don't have a good vibe on it and to just leave it alone. There are stayaways. To me, that one was a stayaway. I'm not shocked at the victor, but I didn't know who was going to win that race. All right, upcoming schedule. I was telling you there's a kind of a quirk of a schedule here. Basically, there's nothing going on in April. We have a whole month here where there's no primaries, and that's kind of how we just decided to want to kind of ramp up in April here for a predictable show. Indiana on May 5th, Ohio on May 5th. There's some interesting stuff there. You got California coming up on June 2nd, and that's the one where it looks like Eric Swalwell, currently the favorite. This dope of a giant nothing is going to be the favorite. This is what happens when you get on TV enough. You run for president, you finish with 1%. People kind of know who you are. You go on TV, you fart, you have sex with a spy. Everyone makes fun of you. And then you're the only person who has any name recognition and you win. That's what's looking like, at least very early on here in California. So lots of stuff to come. We've got Rob Eno. We've got Dan Andrews. We've got a great show ahead. Don't go anywhere. Back in a second. I'm joined now by Dan Andrews, of course. He is the managing editor at CBN News, host of CBN's Quick Start podcast. And you can, of course, subscribe to that wherever you get your podcasts. Dan, welcome in.
All right. Thanks, Stu.
Yeah. And as you know, if you've been watching the show for a while, I'm going to be starting a new program called Predictable. It's a show about prediction markets. And we can announce today that Dan Andrews is going to be part of the team, joining the team at Predictable. Dan, I feel like if we go back 1,000 years from when we were in, like, you know, middle school together, we were talking about stats constantly then, mostly about sports at that point. So it's just a natural evolution of our friendship and relationship over many of these years that we would do a show together based, of course, on stats.
Right. We finally found a way to combine the things we just naturally chat about every day and goof around about and combine it with work. So.
It's the perfect way to go. It's the perfect way to go. And we'll be joining, of course, starting up with Predictable here in just a few weeks. So very excited about that. One of the things that we probably talked too much about back in the day, Dan, when we were having these conversations in like high school, was the WNBA. And I will say at that time, not a particularly charitable view of the WNBA. Among our conversations back then. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of truth. I mean, people probably watch the evolution on this show, Student Does America. You're on in the early days, 2020. If we brought up the WNBA, you would have been very negative on it. Then the hero of the WNBA, Caitlin Clark, came around. You got into it, as did I. I mean, it's been a lot of fun to watch over the past couple of years, at least in games that she plays.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not watching some other random two teams in the WNBA at this point yet. I mean, I, you know, if Caitlin Clark is on, like, she's must watch TV because, you know, she shoots it from 800 feet and it's, you know, something that not a lot of people do, not even all the guys. So,
yeah, it's a lot of fun to watch. Well, the WNBA is, you know, as you would expect with the WNBA, right? Like, if you finally had something go right in their existence, right? Where Caitlin Clark, the star, comes out of nowhere. People are watching these games. You know, there was a tweet that went viral recently. I think it was maybe around the NBA or NHL All-Star game. And they were, I mean, or was the Olympics, I think maybe. And they were saying like, oh yeah, well, women's basketball gets better ratings than the hockey players get. And it's like, you know, this is a big slam on the hockey players, as if they're, you know, as valuable, a league as the NHL. And, you know, of course, that's just solely Caitlin Clark, right? They put her on every single week, and every single week she puts up huge ratings until she gets hurt, and then no one watches again for 2 months.
No, and the fact that they're pushing, Stu, this collective bargaining agreement, like, it's absolutely insane that they, it's kind of like DEI gets thrown in there. It's like, you're on the right trajectory. You've got a golden goose here that's actually getting you some more revenue, but you're still not profitable. And so you still have a ways to go in order to get on a same level, at least percentage wise, with what the NBA players make. But they're almost like they're trying to fumble the bag here, and they're not doing it the right way. And they're just like pushing for more than they should be asking for at this point. But it's because people are shoving this narrative and they're buying it, like, yeah, we're not getting the same as the guys. What's up with that? Right. And so they might be dooming themselves.
Yeah, well, this is what's hilarious about this. The reason this conversation is even happening is the WNBA essentially kind of went on strike, or at least some sort of they were threatening to go on strike. And now they have, I guess, reached this agreement in principle. It's a new collective bargaining agreement. It happened early today. A new salary cap, which will start at $7 million, roughly the price of the worst player on your roster in the WNBA, up from $1.5 million. Their salary cap was $1.5 million, Dan, which is absolutely hilarious.
Because you're losing money. And so this is interesting because the league proposed a 50% of net revenue. So they wanted the 50% thing because the regular NBA, I think, is around 50% of revenue. And but the players wanted 30% of the gross. Now, the problem with that, because they're saying, hey, the guys are getting this and we're not getting this. Again, the guys are profitable. They're making billions of dollars in profit after the expenses. So it's way more amenable to the owners to say, okay, we can do that, because they still come out ahead. In the WNBA, if you're taking 30% of the gross and you're losing hundreds of millions of dollars, it doesn't help. You're just losing more money. You're making the debt go even more by forcing them to pay a higher salary. It's insane.
Yeah, like, a profit share is one thing. That's not what this is. This is they want a gross revenue share. So you picture, like, if you have a business, so you have a restaurant, right, where you're selling, you know, $500 of hamburgers and your food cost is $700. And then your workers want a share of the revenue. That just means you're going to lose more money. Right? Like, that's right. It's going to go on and on and on and on and on. And remember, like, if you look at the valuation of these franchises, you know, the WNBA, again, the salary cap was $1.5 million. Don't ask me how I know this, but a recent valuation of the Charlotte Hornets was $3.6 billion. Right. That's how much the Hornets, wasn't it the Lakers that just sold at a $10 billion valuation? Yeah. The Celtics, like, $6 or $7 billion.
These two things are not the same. No. And if you compared it to, like, the NBA of the 19, because the NBA did not get this massive, you know, revenue sharing until they were profitable in the mid 1980s, when the NBA was saved by Magic Johnson and Larry Bird and that rivalry. And then Jordan came along and it just, you know, all at the same time. They didn't. If the NBA did this in 1976, they probably wouldn't be a league right now. You know, because they would have forced everybody to be paying these salaries and they would have gone under because the NBA was struggling in the 1970s. And so guys would just have to negotiate their own contracts back then individually. They weren't forcing them to make these. Oh, well, I demand it. It's like, well, it's just not there. It's not there. Like, so you just got to deal with reality.
Yeah, which is a very difficult thing to do. Let me move on here, Dan, to an interesting story. And I think maybe a change in the, or at least maybe a hint of a change in the way conservatives look at a major thing in life. I thought this was very interesting. And the reason why, I mean, immediately when I saw it, I thought of you, because this is something you've been saying for a long time. It's a tweet from Matt Walsh. It's got 25,000 likes. Did any of your tweets about this, by the way, Dan, get 25,000 likes? I mean, Matt's a machine,
haven't commented on Israel or Tucker Carlson or whatever. So, like, I'm not, you know, whatever you're supposed to comment on that day. I don't ever do that. So my tweets get, like, you know, 5 likes.
Perfect. I mean, you're the perfect person to bring onto my new venture so we get no social media attention whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. But
Matt Walsh tweets this. He says, I used to be entirely in the camp that said you should kick your kids out at 18 and force them to live independently and make their own way in the world. I don't feel that way at all anymore. I want my kids to live with us until they get married. Even after they're married, if they want to live on our property or close by, my wife and I would love that. The important thing to teach your kids is responsibility, which we're doing. They need to contribute and help around the house, which all of our kids have done from a very young age. Provided you aren't raising ungrateful, useless moochers, why kick them out? Why drive them away from your family home? I don't see the point in it anymore. I actually like my kids and I like being around them. Maybe they'll all end up scattered to the wind, but I prefer to keep the family together. Why wouldn't I? This is something that I think I noticed this from you. I mean, years ago, talking about this, we've come on the show and talked about this idea many, many times. And I don't know, it feels like a sea change a little bit around conservatives, where it kind of was when I was growing up, that idea of like, oh, rough and tumble. Do you believe these liberals keep their kids in the house till they're 35 years old? It does seem to be changing among conservatives. Why is that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly what the awakening is. But, you know, if you look at it and, you know, from a Christian perspective, which, you know, I'm a Christian, so I look at things through that lens, like people in biblical times did not do what, you know, modern Americans do, like the kick them out at 18 thing. Like, there's no biblical example of get the kid out of there. You know, in fact, it's the exact opposite. It's, you know, the prodigal son. He's like coming back after he like goes around and he screws up his inheritance and comes back. But, you know, it's hard to say like what it is that's, you know, causing the sea change. Maybe it's like kind of a forced sort of reality of how expensive everything is. And people are just kind of thinking like, why am I like tossing my kid, like you wouldn't throw, like to teach him to swim, you wouldn't like throw him off a cruise ship and be like, hey, figure it out. You know, it's so difficult out there right now with, I mean, look at a price of a house, like the average prices of houses. I don't know how you even consider buying a house when you're like fresh out of college or something. It's just in the areas where it's just ridiculous. And so, you know, there's that necessity of just cost, right? Like number one. But then number two, like there's that anti sort of like that liberal idea of like, oh, like my kids, you know, and the wine moms and stuff. And they're just like constantly annoyed at their kids. And like Matt's point was like, well, I actually like my kids. And I think we're also seeing, you know, in culture, there's this push to go against the nuclear family and to push against the nuclear family. And I think maybe there's sort of a kind of a pendulum swing against that, saying, wait a minute, I don't hate my kids and I'm not annoyed by my kids. And I want to do the best for my kids and set them up for success the best way that I can. And one of the ways to do that is by giving them a place that they can start out life and not be a gazillion dollars in debt.
Yeah. And it's interesting, Dan, because like, I do see some value because what you said about throwing your kids into the water, you don't really want to do that with no controls, but like at some level too, it is important for them to do things on their own and do things independently and not be constantly coddled by mommy and daddy. So I think there's a value to that. But the other side, like I think back at life after leaving the house in a place where you're very much, you know, you probably don't have any money. You're struggling to get through that existence. There's something good about that struggle, but it's also a time where you make a lot of really bad decisions, I would argue. Like you're kind of pushed into a position where you're not, you know, where you feel like you're struggling all the time.
you probably don't make the best decisions. You know, you're probably going out maybe too much or whatever the situation is. And I don't know, like if there's a way to help ease that so that there isn't that period we all look back on and say, gosh, I was an idiot back when I was 19 and 20 and 22. And, you know, maybe trying to ease that a little bit out isn't a terrible thing. And I will also agree, like, I actually like my kids. Like, we're out on a, you know, we're on a little vacation. We didn't know we were going to be doing shows this week. So we're away for a couple of days. And it's like, all I think about it when I think about my kids leaving the house is like how much I'm going to hate it, right? Like, I, selfishly, I'm just like, it's going to be terrible when they're gone. There's not that many years left. I keep thinking of that all the time. I'm not thinking about, gosh, I want to get them out of the house as fast as possible.
Yeah, and you know what else too? I think with technology has forced so many people to be individual and staring at their phones. And I don't know, my family, when we were growing up, we used to have like weekend picnics all the time and the family would come in. And I feel like that's not a thing anymore. Like at least in a lot of American neighborhood, like people just aren't doing the whole, hey, my whole family's getting together this weekend for cookout. And it just doesn't happen that much. And so that's like another thing when you set up the situation where, you know, like the young kids in the family, when they're a young family and they're creating their own families and they're around, and then, you know, you got the grandparents around and they're all kind of there either on the same property or nearby, you know, you can create that. And I think people are longing for that. They're longing for something other than staring at their screen.
Yeah, that would be nice. Dan Andros joining the predictable team. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be hopefully a little profitable and helping people, you know, cash in a little bit on these new prediction markets, and also just learning a lot about the world, these elections and everything going on. You go to predictableshow.com. You can join up there. Dan's going to be helping to write on the Substack there, which is going to be great. And of course, helping out on the show as well. Dan, we're so, I mean, look, we've been talking about this for 100 years, actually doing something like this together. I'm so pumped to be able to do it starting here in just a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I am too. And listen, I'm so pumped. I'll start saying crazier things on my social media so that, you know, the algorithm likes me, I guess. I'll just think of the craziest thing I can say, and then hopefully we'll get some more attention to it.
Yes, ruin that reputation, Dan. Yeah. That's what we need to do for clicks. Yeah. Dan Andros from CBN News. Thanks so much.
All right. See ya.
It's a new piece in The Federalist. Title is Transgender Skepticism is the Ultimate Bipartisan Issue. And it's an interesting framing. It's written by Chris Bray. He wrote the subheadline, a pro-LGB culture is deeply disturbed by the T. People you mostly wouldn't agree with you on this. This is an interesting thing. He writes it out as it might not be an 80-20 issue. It might be a 90-10 issue. And, you know, I think it connects. One of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, because it connects closely to what we talked about the other day with Buck Sexton. He was on the show. And he was talking, and he brought up several times kind of as the example of this sort of mass delusion that he wrote about in his new book that you should totally pick up, is about the transgender culture. And it becomes a thing where everybody you know that says they support trans issues knows they're wrong. And it might not be on the surface. It might not be, something they think about logically every day. Like, I know I'm wrong on this, but I have to defend my position. I think after a while, as Buck wrote about, it becomes part of your identity. And then instead of defending the trans issue, you're defending you. You're defending yourself as a human. Like, these are the things that I believe, and people are attacking the things I believe. Therefore, I must defend them. Very natural human instinct, but something like, not every instinct is the right thing to embrace, right? Part of having instinct as a human being and us rising above animals is not always giving into those instincts, right? It's fighting against them. It's finding a place where you could say, wait a minute, I'm catching myself falling for something that I shouldn't because of instinct, and I need to stop that. It's the same thing with emotion. You talk to your children about this, like, hey, our emotions are kind of taking over here. Let's think about what's going on here. Is it really that bad? It's a difficult thing to get across to children, but it's also a difficult thing to get across to adults, especially when they're on social media all the time, having this stuff beaten into their heads. I think it's the right thing to understand that we shouldn't give ground on the truth here. We don't have to be a-holes about it. We don't have to be jerks about it all the time. What we need to be, I think, is not backing down off the truth. I don't feel bad believing that men and men are men and women are women. You can't change that with a series of magic words. That's not, like, I'm not the one who's out of step with science here. Something that we have to understand, even when it feels like we're being attacked, and calmly continue to state the truth without ever backing down an inch. I'm joined once again by Rob Eno, managing editor of Blaze News. Now, we are taping the show, or taping this on Tuesday, because I'm going to be on the road for Wednesday's show. We wanted to get this, make sure we had a segment ready with Rob, and that's why he's wearing his world's tallest
leprechaun t-shirt. Yes. So if you're confused.
Yeah, it wouldn't make much sense the day after St. Patrick's Day, but here we are on St. Patty's Day taping. And here you are looking wonderful.
Excellent.
In your bright green.
I am excited to be on the penultimate episode of Stu Does America.
That's right.
I am kind of concerned that when, you know, Ted Cruz, Mike Huckabee, and Lindsey Graham found out that Stu Does America was ending, that they decided to launch an apocalyptic war in the Middle East with Bibi Netanyahu. Isn't it fun that, like, everybody in this thing thinks that it's an apocalypse? Like, the gay, apparently gay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The apparently gay, new Ayatollah, thinks it's an apocalyptic war. We've got Glenn's favorite person, Alexander Dugan, thinks that all wars should be apocalyptic wars.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We've got... the dispensationalists think that, you know, Gog and Magog need to fight each other, and somehow that involves Iran or something.
Stuff.
I can't keep track of it. It was nice of them to start the apocalyptic war because they thought that they were so distraught about your show ending that they started one, not knowing that you and Dave Landau would double team or tag team America.
Yeah, I don't prefer the double team language.
Tag team.
I prefer
tag team.
You. Okay, that's a little slightly better.
Yeah.
I will say the show started with an apocalypse, which was COVID. And it was like 6 weeks after we started the show, COVID hit. And why not end it with
one? It's a good bookend.
It's a good.
It's a really good bookend for the show.
Now, Rob, I don't know if you know this. We talked a little bit about this at one point because we weren't going over the most. The people who've been on the show the most. You are the fifth most recurring guest on this program in its 6-year run.
Wow.
42 appearances on the show. You're in fifth. Sarah Gonzalez in fourth. Rob Buttrell in third. Dan Andrews second. Glenn Beck first. Good group you're with there.
Yes.
It's a great group. The thing I did not remember, though, they gave me a little rundown of all this. You were the third guest ever on this show. Is that right?
So I came
February 12th, 2020.
And then, like, 3 weeks later, we couldn't be together.
Yes, whatever happened, you screwed it up. But you did come on very early.
Yes, and I think I had to go for a COVID test at one point in time.
Really? I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Certainly, it's certainly possible. There was a COVID.
Yeah, there was a COVID scare. Yeah,
that was there was a situation where I caught COVID the only time that I know that I caught COVID was very early on. I guess it was maybe summer.
Right, and I was coming back to the office.
You were coming back to the office, and I was. I went out to my friend's birthday party. Of course, caught COVID, and then came in. I had zero symptoms.
Right.
I came and did an interview face to face with a guest here in the studio, and then I realized it was after I had already had you on. I called you. I was like, hey, just so you know, I mean, I don't.
Yeah. So
I know we're not going to all panic about this, but like you might want to know so you're not spreading it to your like elderly grandma.
Right. I only got it. I got COVID at the same place twice. The Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, Florida.
That I would say that's probably
like
still
the
happening
only
in that
two times
facility.
I got COVID. That's where I got it.
Is that a nice facility?
It's nice, but the air circulation system is horrible.
Okay.
It's just like it doesn't get the smoke out.
That makes sense. I lived in Tampa for many years, so that very well makes sense. You get a lot of smoky rooms there. Now, let's look at the because you're kind of like the media expert here for the Blaze. You do that stuff all the time. You do all sorts of stuff around here, but we always have you on for these media questions. We've had a 6-year run here from the beginning. You think of pre-COVID era all the way up until today. You've seen many, many changes, I think, in the media. Give me your kind of 50,000-foot view. How would you describe the changes over the past 6 years?
I think the corporate-wise, some of the media has gotten more neutral. I'm not going to say conservative.
Sure.
I'm going to say neutral.
That's great.
I mean, the Washington Post, I think that Jeff Bezos, surprisingly, has done a great job of making that more of a centrist newspaper.
At least on the editorial page.
At least on the editorial page. I mean, but I think even with the people that are writing, there are a lot of people that left because he made the editorial pages more down the center. So I think
they didn't endorse Kamala Harris during the election, which was a big point of contention for the left.
Right. And you're seeing that the LA Times, the guy that owns the LA Times now, has done the same thing. You know, they've gone back to news. I think that the people with journalism degrees that got them, you know, in the 70s, 60s to, you know, the early 2000s, even to now, journalism was an activist thing. It wasn't reporting. You went into journalism because you wanted to make a difference.
Yes, right.
Right. And I think we're getting back to more reporting. I think you see that with CBS News. I mean, Gavin Newsom was apoplectic, as were a lot of Democratic strategists, that Barry Weiss's CBS had the gall to go to California and uncover fraud.
Right.
You saw that, like the gall.
Wow.
Yeah. Why are you picking on Gavin Newsom when there's so many more targets? It was some Democratic strategist said, and my one word Twitter, well, my one sentence Twitter response was, "Oh, you let it out in the open."
Right, right, because that's what we all knew was going on. But now, I mean, I think you're right. I think your view here of at least guarded optimism, I think, is the right one. The way I would describe the road from 2020 to today was initially a hardcore turn to the left. Like, you know, as we entered into COVID and then into the George Floyd era, we went way, I would say, off the road,
right,
on the left side, past the oncoming traffic, all the way into the cornfield on the side of the road. And then since then have come back, and I think come back a little bit farther, at least in certain respects, to the sane side than we even were in 2019.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And you saw it in things like, you know, Warner Brothers buys CNN, or Discovery buys CNN. Mm-hmm. The guy that was the head of Discovery, I forget his name, but owned Cablevision, the libertarian.
Mm-hmm. Kind of improved things a little bit.
Improved a little bit, got brought in somebody who fired Brian Stelter.
Yes.
My favorite person.
Your favorite person.
And then that person leaves, so Brian Stelter comes back, and now you have the Ellisons buying Warner Brothers from Discovery. I don't think they're buying all of Discovery. They're just going to spin off Warner Brothers. They're going to buy Warner Brothers from the Discovery Corporation, because anytime somebody buys Warner Brothers, or it becomes horrible, like Time Magazine did, you know, you want to get rid of it. So they're going to do that. And then the Ellisons, who are super MAGA, are now going to own CBS News and CNN. The people at CNN are apoplectic about it.
Yep, they are.
And I mean, you worked at CNN when we used to make fun of it for being the Clinton News Network.
Yes.
But it was certainly more centrist than it is now.
They at least tried.
Yeah, they don't try.
They were biased, but they tried to appear as if they were not biased. Now they are just biased and they don't even try to hide it a lot of times.
Correct.
Not everybody on their coverage, to be clear. There's some, they do some things that are pretty good, but it's limited, as you know.
I mean, Barry Weiss in charge of CNN is going to be beautiful.
I mean, that's a great improvement. Again, and there are people on the right who don't like Barry Weiss. I mean, I know, you know, like, you know, that's fine. But she's undoubtedly better than what we've seen, right? And I, you know, I tend to like her, but like, I understand if you don't like everything that she does or you don't appreciate her coverage, that's fine. But you have to, I think, acknowledge that at least it's not awful on everything, which is the standard we've been used to for many years.
Right. And if you look at Barry Weiss, I mean, she's like Adam Carolla, right? And she's like Bill Maher. Those guys will get together and tell you, you know, I think Adam Carolla was out and he's like, I'm not a conservative.
Right, right.
It's just, I am not whatever this is.
Right.
Right. And I think that that's what Bill Maher and Barry Weiss and Adam Carolla are like. We're not like, you know, Bible thumping, you know, conservatives.
Yeah.
But we're not what this is.
Right. I think it's like Bill Maher is a great example of this, because I think the conservative experience, conservative media experience with Bill Maher is, you know, The Blaze or Daily Wire or one of these, you know, places goes out and picks a great clip from Bill Maher where he is like against something that's woke, or he's calling out. He did a great thing the other day where he was calling out Adam Schiff on the war. And he said, like, oh, here's a quote about the war from the administration. And of course, he's very critical of it. And then he says, well, this is the Obama administration. He kind of catches him in a lie. And we see those clips. And then if you are one of those people who like those clips, you might tune into a show. And when you tune into a show, you realize he's actually a liberal guy, right? Like, he's not a conservative. He's just less insane than whatever this is, whatever direction that has been turned over the past few years.
I mean, I think the radio show went national right after 9/11, right? That's what you said.
Yeah.
So so you remember Bill Maher gets into all kinds of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Did anybody sit back, and even then, sit back and see what Bill Maher said? What Bill Maher said is, oh, you mean what Bill Clinton did wasn't great? Mm. Like, that's what he said. Oh, just throwing bombs at them?
Yeah.
Didn't do anything? Like, that's all he said. And it was basically a huge critique of Bill Clinton's response to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And all the conservatives were like, oh, my God, no, he attacked. Like, George Bush was president for 9 months. It wasn't a critique on George Bush.
Right.
It was a critique on... Yeah, and I always just didn't get that.
No, I know. And Glenn, I remember at the time defending Bill Maher and saying, look, I might not necessarily, because he also said something about how, like, oh, well, the Al-Qaeda, well, they're the brave ones. They're the ones who are at least crashing planes in their building. We're just firing bombs from across the across the globe or whatever. And it was seen at the time as this kind of anti-patriotic in that moment. But Glenn defended him and said, look, you know, the bottom line is the show's named politically incorrect with Bill Maher. Like, he should be able to have these opinions that are a little bit out of the mainstream. Argue with him, but you don't toss him off the air for that. And, you know, I stand by that. I think even on the right, sometimes you see this, certainly on the left all the time, is when you see an opinion that you don't like, you try to get that person fired, you try to get that person excommunicated from all society. And I'm sure you're the same way. I didn't get into this business for that. Like, I have
it's
no
why I was,
interest
I
in
mean,
it.
I was upset with what Brendan Carr did this weekend and said that. Because you set that precedent, then it's going to be used against me.
Yeah. And it's just and it's just like, you know, again, like, I know he's got some defense to this, but it's like, broadly speaking, I don't want the government involved in speech at all, really. Like, I mean, you have to press up against real hard legal lines. I mean, you go back to the Brandenburg standard. I'm fine with it. Like, it should be incredibly limited what the government can do with speech, and it should have to hit super high standards. And that is, you know, at this point, not really the way that we're looking at it. Well, we've got Stu and Dave Do America. This is the penultimate show.
My second
favorite word. What's the first one again?
Bombogenesis. Bomb cyclone. It's when a winter storm gets very, very strong.
The beginning of that process.
Right. Well, it's the process by which the pressure drops dramatically and it becomes a cyclone, even though it's not a hurricane.
I mean, that's a
good
word.
It's bombogenesis.
I've never even heard that one. That's a great word.
I grew up in New England. So
you can come on. I would love to, of course, have you with Dave as well in the new show, Stu and Dave Do America, to teach us new words and tell us whatever Brian Stelter's up to.
If we get past the apocalypse.
Right. That's around the corner, so we'll have to wait for that. Rob, thanks for all your service here on this program. It's very much appreciated. It's always great to have you on, and we'll see you on the new show.
Thank you.
All right, tomorrow, the final show of Stu Does America until we transition into Stu and Dave Do America after about a week off. We will come back on April 1st with a brand new shows. Just so you know, there's some complications as to where you're going to get these shows. For example, the show, if you're on YouTube right now, this is where you will be getting the new shows from Predictable. If you search for Stu and Dave Do America, it's going to be on a different channel, basically. It's like the old Normal World channel. That's where it's going to be located. We just had to, like, you know, use these channels the best way that we could. So this will be predictableshow.com soon, and you will be going over there. We'll remind you of that. There are explainer videos, by the way. I just did one the other day, just kind of walking you through where you need to go for each feed. If you're listening on audio, same sort of thing. Predictable will be on this audio feed. It'll be a different feed, Stu and Dave Do America. On the audio side, we'll walk you through all of it as we go through it. But I appreciate your patience as we get all this stuff launched here in the next couple weeks. All right, see you tomorrow for the final Stu Does America.